rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, what do you do when people want to bring down your country and kill your people because you published a cartoon? It's an interesting question. It's germane. Welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Andrew Bernstein is with us with the Ayn Rand Organization, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the philosophical forebearers, shall we say, of the libertarians and the modern conservatives, although I know you have great disdain for both, Andrew. Welcome to the program.
Oh, good to be back, Tom.
Andy is also the visiting professor of philosophy at Marist College and specializes in objectivism, capitalism, and business ethics at Ayn Rand, and is the author of a new book titled...
The Capitalist Manifesto.
There you go. So, Andy, I think you and I can agree that, just like when they went after Salman Rushdie, this is nuts.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I think it should be very clear that all human beings have the right to freedom of intellectual expression. And personally, I think the cartoons are idiotic, and I wouldn't have published them normally. But under these circumstances, where freedom of intellectual expression, freedom of speech, is under attack, I think people need newspapers need to publish these cartoons to show that they won't capitulate to terrorism.
And yet the official position of the Catholic Church up until just a decade or so ago was that Galileo was a blasphemer and should have been put to death.
Right. And that's
and anybody who believed in his doctrines was in that category.
Right. And religion, historically, whether it's Christianity or Islam or any other religion, has historically very often been opposed to reason and to freedom of the mind. And it's not just religion, but secularists as well, like the Nazis and the communists. We need to stand up for the sacred right of the First Amendment, the sacred right of freedom of speech and freedom of intellectual expression against any and all oppressors who would violate our rights and kill us simply because we have thoughts that they consider blasphemous.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Now, what would you do about it? What do you think we should do about the Islamic protests all around the world?
Well, a couple of things. I think there's an intellectual battle here as well as a police/military battle. And I think the Western governments, all of them, and governments around the world, for that matter, need to proclaim the inalienable right of all their citizens to express thoughts considered blasphemous, and then back it with force against any of the murderers, terrorists, or regimes who support the terrorists.
What the European countries have done, who have published these, and there's about a dozen of them now, who have essentially gone out of their way to publish these cartoons to
right.
say, we have freedom of the press here. They have been published in the United States, although the U.S. government has not, said, we salute that or anything like that, but some of these other countries have. Is to simply publish them and then just let the chips fall where they may. But you're suggesting what? Should we drop should we shoot into crowds of protesters?
Not protesters. I mean, protesters have the same right of intellectual expression as do the journalists.
Well, you said use of force. What do you mean?
Well, I mean people who would kill. Who would physically attack the blasphemers? For instance, the murder of Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands a couple of years ago.
Well, the guy who killed him has been caught. He's been sitting for the rest of his life in a prison in Holland.
Well, let's hope he's there for the rest of his life. I think the murderer should be executed. But also, I think, don't forget, there are regimes who support these kind of terrorist activities, notably Iran, and I'm not just referring to the Rushdie debacle. And I think the Iranian regime simply has to be toppled. I thought so in 1979, Tom, when Khomeini sent in his goons to take over the U.S. Embassy. Never mind now.
But Iran right now, Andrew Bernstein, Iran is, their form of government is almost indistinguishable from what we just helped create in Iraq. That is, you have a constitutionally elected parliament, you have a constitutionally appointed elected president and appointed prime minister, and you have what we would call a Supreme Court, which has the right to strike down laws, which is and strikes those laws down in accordance with Islam, with the principles of Islam. And we just put that into place in Iraq, and that's what they have in Iran. And, of course, that's the big stumbling block, is the mullahs use their equivalent of the Supreme Court to strike down laws and issue decrees. Are you suggesting that because of that we should attack a country?
Yeah, I think the Iranian regime should have been toppled in 1979. I'm not going to defend.
How?
I'm not going to defend what Bush has done in Iraq. I think it's a big mistake at many levels. But to say that there's free elections in Iran, I mean, that's a sham. The people are intimidated by the religious police. There's no possibility of electing secularists in Iran with that current regime.
Well, actually, the president before the current president was a secularist.
Yeah, but he's a figurehead, Tom. He's no power. The mullahs run.
Passed laws. It's just that the mullahs struck them down.
Right. Well, exactly right. Any secular arm of the government.
So how is the solution to that we should go to war with them? Why shouldn't we provide them with an example of democracy that they want so badly that they're going to get rid of their mullahs?
Well, I think that regime has to come down any way we could do it, whether it's by there is a dissident movement in Iran. If we can supply and sponsor the dissidents the way the Reagan CIA did Solidarity in Poland in the 1980s, and you have an uprising against the Ayatollahs, that's fine. But I think one way or another that regime has to come down, and the moral principle here is self-defense. They sponsor more terrorism against us than any regime has ever done in the whole history of the struggle over the last 25 years.
Andrew, the 14 of the 19 hijackers are from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but...
And the Saudis are the ones who are exporting Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is far more toxic, both to us and to Israel, than is the variety of Shia Islam that's being preached by the Ayatollahs in Iran.
Well, I agree with you about the Saudi regime. And
so do you think we should bomb Saudi Arabia as well?
I think Bush is making a big mistake in supporting the Saudi regime. But getting back to Iran, they're the ones who sponsor Hezbollah. They're the ones who have whole conventions of terrorist organizations in Tehran. They're the ones who are calling for a 20-year plan for the Islamists to conquer the world. They're the main threat here.
They're not the only ones. The United Arab Emirates has signed on for this, Andrew Bernstein, and I assume that you think that it's just fine that they buy our port facilities.
No, I don't.
It's a corporation.
I absolutely disagree. I think it creates all kinds of security problems. And I think
Ayn Rand is rolling in a grave, Andrew.
I think Bush is making a big mistake in letting Arab companies run the ports. Why do you think Ayn Rand would roll in her grave over that?
Because it's a corporation. Shouldn't corporations be allowed to do whatever they want? It's a free market. After all, our ports are for sale. Just because they happen to be Arabs, why shouldn't they be allowed to buy our ports?
Because it creates security issues. What kind of profiling do they have? How are they going to keep terrorists out of their organization? The legitimate role of the government is to protect individual rights from killers. And I don't think free trade is a moral absolute, Tom. I don't think, for instance, the U.S. government should have permitted private companies to trade with Hitler's Germany or with Soviet Russia. These are regimes who are dedicated to our destruction. And I don't think we should be permitted to trade with Iran.
But Grandpa Prescott Bush was trading with Hitler during World War II. He got caught and, you know, lost his company over it.
Yeah, I think that's morally right. I think the government should prohibit trading with any country that you can demonstrably demonstrate as a physical threat to American lives. And the Iranian regime is a major threat. I mean,
This is really interesting. I'm hearing you say, Andy Bernstein, that you think that if a corporation represents a demonstrable threat to we the people, that we the people should push back. How is it different that the corporation run by the UAE has affiliation with a company that, you know, doesn't like our form of government, for example, or however you want to characterize it? How is that different from a corporation that is putting a poison into the air that's killing our children?
If that's true, then that corporation should be held criminally responsible. Or if it's inadvertent on their part, if they don't realize it, at the very least, the civil court should put an end to that. If it's done with any intent, that's a criminal action. Just the fact that somebody's a big corporation doesn't give them the right to violate my rights or yours. And I think, you know, if those guys in Enron are guilty of more than negligence, if they're guilty of defrauding their shareholders, then those guys should not only go to jail, but I think their money should be confiscated and paid back to the shareholders they defrauded.
So then you would say that the corporation...
violate my rights.
I mean, we have, for example, the Vermont law was being argued before the United States Supreme Court a couple days ago, and it looks like John Roberts is going to say, hey, corporations are persons. They have rights just like everybody else. They should have the right to give as much money as they want to a candidate. You got no problem with that?
No, I agree with that. I think corporations have as much rights as anybody else and as much limitations as anybody
else. But they're not anybody else.
They have fewer rights or more rights than a poor philosophy professor like me.
They can't vote.
What's that to do with it?
Why are they participating in our electoral process if they can't vote?
Well, I mean, the shareholders and owners of a corporation have the right to do with their money as they please. If they want to give it to Bush or Kerry or, I mean, you know, for
instance, we're not talking about the shareholders. We're talking about the corporation.
A lot of corporations are big, you know, contributors to Democratic candidates. I don't think there should be any limits on how much George Soros could give to Kerry or Hillary Clinton.
You're talking about a human being now, not a corporation. I mean, there's a very significant difference. Interesting conversation. Andy Bernstein, author of the new book. The title is?
The Capitalist Manifesto, Tom.
There you go. A-Y-N-R-A-N-D, the Ayn Rand Institute.
My website is andrewbernstein.net.
Andrewbernstein.net. Thank you for reminding me, Andy. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Truth in Broadcasting. Truth and occasionally a little bit of common sense here just as well. Boy, an amazing story coming out of Ohio, an absolutely amazing story, so amazing that it's time for a voting machine election alert!
Just a touch of a screen. Welcome to the future. Come try our voting machine.
Indeed. Well, this actually goes a little beyond the voting machines. This is amazing. Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman breaking this story yesterday did 308,000 canceled Ohio voter registrations put Bush back in the White House. This is how to steal an election, even if the voting machines are clean. And, of course, that's a whole other question is, you know, what's the deal with the voting machines?
So the whole thing seems clean.
Yeah, well, this, as I said, this even goes beyond that. The George W. Bush won the presidency of the United States by, 119,000 votes, as I recall. I have the exact number around here someplace. Anyhow, I'll find it for you. And, interestingly, 175,000, they just discovered this. Fetrakis and Wasserman just discovered this. 175,000 voters in Cuyahoga County. That's Cleveland. This is an area that went over 70% for Bush, in some areas 90% for Bush. It's the traditional stronghold of the Ohio Democratic Party. 175,000 people were removed from the voting rolls by Ken Blackwell just before the 2004 election. Now, if you think that's bad, there were an additional 10,000 people who registered to vote from that county, Cuyahoga County, just before the 2004 election, who somehow got lost due to what they called a clerical error. And now, if you think that's bad, now that's 175 plus 10,000, that's 185. And then there's 133,000 votes who were purged from the registration rolls in Hamilton County, Cincinnati, which is principally Democratic, and Lucas County, Toledo, principally Democratic. So here we have the three big cities in Ohio, which are traditionally Democratic, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Toledo, and between these three cities, the Democratic stronghold, 105,000 from Cincinnati, 28,000 from Toledo, 175,000 from Cleveland. In aggregate, we're looking at 308,000 people who, when they showed up to vote, were told, "I'm sorry, you're not registered to vote, leave." And Bush won, and I put that in quotation marks, by 119,000 votes. 119,000. As Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman note in their article over at freepress.org, exit polls flash worldwide on CNN at 12:20 a.m. Wednesday morning, November 3rd, showing John Kerry winning Ohio by 4.2% of the popular vote. probably about 250,000 votes. Now, if they had bounced 308,000 votes out of these counties that are 70 to 90% Democratic, then in all probability, the exit poll that showed that John Kerry won by 250,000 votes was absolutely accurate. I mean, just think about it. You know, what is between 70 and 90% of 308,000? More or less a quarter million, 250,000. And that's what CNN reported at midnight Wednesday, the night of the vote, that John Kerry had won Ohio by 4.2% of the popular vote, a quarter of a million votes. Now, at that time, CNN didn't know that 133,000 voters had been eliminated from the registration rolls in Cincinnati and Toledo. And from that day until this, well, until 2 days ago when this story first broke, nobody knew that an additional 175,000 voters had been purged from Cuyahoga County, from Cleveland, which is the most Democratic of the Democratic area. This is Dennis Kucinich's district. 175,000 people pulled out of the rolls. Thus, we understand why on Election Day itself, Ken Blackwell met personally with George W. Bush, Karl Rove, and Matt Damschroeder, the chairman of the Columbus Board of Elections, the Franklin County Board of Elections, formerly the chair of the county's Republican Party. And by the way, the Board of Elections in Toledo, the chairperson, Bernadette Noe, the wife of Tom Noe, Mr. Republican, you know, the guy with the 53 counts of fraud, theft, and other felonies, and the disappearance of $13 million in state funds. It was his wife who was in charge of the elections in Toledo. So he's stealing the money of the people of Ohio, and she's responsible for making sure that everything's just hunky-dory with the vote in Ohio. They go on to point out that there's no law that requires this 308,000 voters be eliminated from the voting rolls. And there's no public verification that has been offered to confirm that these people had not voted in previous elections. In other words, Ken Blackwell is saying, I took them off the rolls, and if you don't like it, go stick your head in the swamp. You know, take a hike. He's saying, I ain't talking. This is outrageous. I hope anybody you know in Ohio, you will call and tell them about this. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Gonna make some inroads, driving home a payload, trucking down the highway like you've never seen.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man, what a day. What a day. We discovered today that George W. Bush and Ken Blackwell actually did steal the election in Ohio. Fairly irrefutable proof of that. At the same time, we discovered today that the United Arab Emirates, through another company called Dubai International Capital, has now confirmed that they have a $1.2 billion deal that they announced back in December to buy Doncaster's Group Limited. This is a British precision engineering company that makes, here in the United States, the engines for our tanks and our military aircraft. So, here you got it, my friends. The United Arab Emirates, the sheikhs of the Emirati, the king of Dubai, manufactures the engines for our tanks, manufactures the engines for our jet fighter planes, and will soon control 21 of our ports. It makes me just a little bit nervous. I have to say, it's got nothing to do with them being Arab. It has a lot to do with them having official policies like participating in the Israeli boycott and not recognizing Israel's right to exist, and being one of the first three countries in the world to recognize the existence of the Taliban and refusing to participate with the United States in the early efforts to, you know, figure out what's going on with 9/11 and on and on and on. And then, of course, we have this 2002 letter now that has just been declassified. This came, you know, by translated by the United States government. It's over at the West Point Combat Terrorism Training Center. And it's a letter to the officials of United Arab Emirates and especially the two emirates of Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Keep in mind, the United Arab Emirates is seven countries. Each country has its own king, and the countries are named after the kings. They're traditionally, you know, tribal families. Abu Dhabi one, Dubai the other. The key sentence, you are well aware that we have infiltrated your security, censorship, and monetary agencies, along with other agencies that should not be mentioned. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Scott in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Scott, what's on the line? What's on your mind today?
I just wanted to call, make a comment about the 300-some-odd thousand votes that were discarded.
Right.
The votes are actually insignificant, in my opinion, because the Electoral College, they're the ones that makes the decision.
Right, but the votes, if you have a majority in the state, okay, Bush took Ohio by 119,000 votes. Had those additional 308,000 voters in areas that go anywhere from 70 to 90% Democratic, had their votes been counted, Bush would have lost Ohio. That means that Ohio's electors, the people who represent Ohio in the Electoral College, would have voted for Kerry instead of Bush, and John Kerry would be president of the United States right now.
But the Electoral College is under no obligation to vote with the majority of the people.
They're not under a legal obligation, but in the 230-plus year history of the United States, only one elector in all that time has voted in a way inconsistent with the will of the people in the state which he's representing. So, you know, the bottom line here, Scott, is that if and Ohio and Florida threatened to do it. You know, Tom Feeney threatened to do it when he was Speaker of the House of Florida back in 2000. He said, well, you know, even if Al Gore wins Florida, we're still going to send Republican electors to Washington, D.C. It never happened. But that was the first time that it's been threatened in the history of the United States. I mean, we've had one elector in one election back in the 19th century actually vote opposite the way he was sent. But the bottom line is, had these 308,000 people not been pulled off the voting rolls by Ken Blackwell, and we know that a lot of them showed up because the provisional ballot count in Ohio was double what it normally is, which are people who were told that they, hey, you're not registered. Well, I want to vote anyway. Okay, here's a provisional ballot. And then it doesn't get counted. So I'd say this is a smoking gun.
Yeah, but see, back in the 60s, which is before my time, plenty of people talk about it, that the electoral votes actually went against the popular vote and won the elections.
Oh, it did. Yeah, it did. In 2000, also, Al Gore won the popular vote by what? Almost 5 million votes. He's not president. That has happened, you know, half dozen times in the history of the United States. If you had the total popular vote across the United States, but on a state by state basis, if those 308,000 people had not been pulled off the voting rolls in these three primarily Democratic cities in the state of Ohio, I guarantee you, and you know, just any, you don't need a statistician to figure it out, that John Kerry would be president of the United States right now. Even if George Bush won a majority of votes nationwide, we don't vote based on a majority of votes. In my opinion, George Bush was never elected. He was appointed by the Supreme Court, with members of the Supreme Court appointed by his daddy in 2000. And he and Ken Blackwell, in my opinion, criminally conspired to steal the vote in the state of Ohio and others as well. I would look at New Mexico and Florida. In New Mexico, for example, Scott, in counties where they had machines and they had paper ballots, in many cases in the same school, in the same precinct where people were showing up to vote, and they just had more voters than they knew what to do with, so they had some paper ballots and they had some machines. Oddly enough, if you voted on a machine, you voted for George Bush more often. The machine count went with Bush. If you voted on a paper ballot, it went for Kerry. And there's no way to explain that, because this was totally randomly selected. And these were in communities that were by and large Democratic, and yet the machine votes went for George W. Bush. This thing just stinks to high heaven, Scott. I'm sorry. I understand your point about the Electoral College, but this is more than just that. Jeff in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, Lucy, the point that you made about the exit polls and the people that were taken off the roll, for one, the rolls are cleansed periodically, and these are probably people that should have been knocked off the rolls anyway. But number two,
I disagree. I agree with you that the voting rolls are constantly and periodically cleansed, but why poll 308,000 people and 175,000 of them keeping it secret up until last week? Why pull 308,000 people out of just the Democratic areas and not go after the Republican areas? You tell me something doesn't stink, Jeff. That is the case.
It doesn't matter. These people, if they were pulled, they were pulled for some reason.
Ken Blackwell has not offered any reason. When asked, he has declined to offer any reason. There is no law in Ohio that says that people have to be pulled off the voting rolls for any particular reason.
I mean, I don't know. I know California, and after a couple of federal elections, if you don't vote, you get knocked off.
That's right.
And it could be the same.
This is not the case here.
But we have to find out if that there is a reason for knocking them off before you can say there's cheating. If there's a good reason that's within...
These guys went to Blackwell's office and asked, and Blackwell's office said, we're not telling you.
Okay. Well, I mean, they can't just do it.
They did. They did. Blackwell's saying, hey, I won. I'm running for governor now. We got these Democrats off the voting rolls. If you don't like it, tough. When Bob Fetrakis tried to sue him over this, he brought the apparatus of the whole state down on him. The state attorney general sued him for a frivolous lawsuit, and they tried to pull his lawyer's license.
That cannot be in. There's a reason, and they can legitimately say that it can be knocked off. I mean, you can't just go knock someone off the roll.
They did. They did it. They did it in Florida in 2000, and they did it in Ohio in 2004. Jeff, you still believe that we have democracy in the United States, and that these Republicans are not criminals, and they are. I'm sorry. It is. We have to stand up to this. We can't just sit around and say. But say what?
It's a bunch of you guys are.
Jeff, I challenge you to do your homework. Go to freepress.org and simply read the site. Simply read the article. Check it out. You'll get it. Bill in Brooklyn, New York, and thanks a lot for the call. Bill in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Listen, I would like to know why the Democratic Party didn't publicize this widely, this lawsuit, back in those days.
Because got Bob Schrum and you've got all these DLC Democrats who, all the way back to Michael Dukakis, have been, you know, let's not rock the boat. We don't want to be seen as whiners. And, frankly, I'm starting to think that we've got Manchurian candidate types running some of these candidates.
I hope that now that with this new information, there will be widespread publicity about this. A lawsuit, not necessarily a winnable lawsuit, because...
there's already several lawsuits going on right now in Ohio about this very issue. Have you heard about any of them in the mainstream media? No.
Well, it just broke, this information. We need a program.
What just broke was the 175,000 additional purged voters in Cuyahoga County. The original 133,000 voters purged in Hamilton County and Lucas County, that story broke a week after the election.
That's irrelevant.
Got no coverage outside the state of Ohio.
That's irrelevant. The important thing is to get a climate for the impeachment of this guy.
Yes.
By publicizing the existence of this lawsuit on the basis of this new information, the Dems have to get it on fast.
And not just impeach George W. Bush, impeach Ken Blackwell as well. Did you see where it's on Common Dreams right now? Did you see where Garrison Keillor is calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush?
Small potatoes. Let's get after Bush.
That's what I just said. When Garrison Keillor, you know, Mr. Lake Wobegon, I mean, Mr. kind of middle-of-the-road Democrat, when folks like Garrison Keillor are coming out and saying it's time to impeach George W. Bush, you know the sentiment of the country is changing. People are waking up across this nation. People are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, enough already. You know, enough people have died in Iraq, enough people have died in Afghanistan, enough depleted uranium has been dropped. We don't need any more nukes. We don't need all this belligerence. We don't want any more stolen elections. We don't want our water more polluted with arsenic. We don't want more mercury in our air. We don't want corporations. We don't want Disneyland buying Yellowstone. Enough already. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to difference. 10 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Monica in Chicago, Illinois on the line. Hey, Monica, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I've been following the Ohio thing ever since the election in 2004, and it's sad. And if you go back and you read Bush's speech on September 20th, 2001, he goes through a litany of stuff that Osama bin Laden hated about America. And one of those was that we freely elect our leaders. And then he stole Ohio. Before that, though, he said Osama hated our free speech. Now, all throughout the election campaign, he set up free speech zones.
Right.
You know, everything in that speech is just, you know, it's so funny. He said that Osama hated our freedom to disagree with each other. Well, then he outed Valerie Plame.
Right.
You know, and it just goes on and on and on and on. So watch what Bush does, not what he says, because they're two totally different things. And I believe that the war on terror threat is just a bunch of bull. I don't believe it. I think it's all lies, and I think that Bush trying to sell the ports to the Dubai company is proof of that.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's all lies, but I think it's extremely hyperinflated, Monica. I'm right there with you. And I agree with you. Watch what they say, watch what they do, not just what they say, but occasionally they say it. You know, it's Bush will just come right out and just kind of let it out.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
I mean, there you go. So,
well, thanks, Tom. You have a good job. You do a great job and keep it up.
Thanks a lot, Monica. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, this whole thing in Ohio. I'm listening to all this stuff. I've been listening to progressive radio for a while now, and it just seems to be making me more angry and angrier. I mean, not that your show makes me angry. It's just that everything you talk about is right, but it's almost as if there's nothing you can do about it. You know, Bush steals and all.
Mike, there is something you can do about it. You can get involved. You can show up at your local Democratic Party meetings. You can join Democracy for America. You can start a local activist group. You can send $10 to any politician you think is worth his salt.
You're right. I can do that. But what I'm seeing is, what's frustrating me more than anything, is the fact that these guys do this stuff, and they're thumbing their noses at the system. And there's no remedy in the sense of, you know, if you did something illegal, you stole an election, you threw votes out. Where's the authorities? Where's the law? Where's the...
Well, the problem is that the Republicans control the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, and the executive branch, and through the Federalist Society, by and large, control most of our federal courts and even a lot of our local courts. And we're only going to get it back if we get active. I'm telling you, thing that they want more than anything else in the world, Mike, is for you and me to be sitting around saying, oh, there's nothing we can do. I guess we should just go home and play a video game.
No, you're right. I agree. There's a lot we can do, but right now it's real frustrating watching this go on.
Right, which means that we have to get active. Success is the best revenge, Mike. We've got to be successful.
I'm going to do what I can to get these guys out in November.
God bless you. Good on you. Thanks a lot for the call. Keep it up. Eric in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Eric.
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
I am just great, but I'll get better. How about you, Eric?
I'm all right. It would seem that with all this information coming out about the machines and the inaccurate counts, how can it be that a state like California just went ahead and approved the use of these machines in the upcoming election?
Oh, no.
Their election.
It is mind-boggling.
Make any sense.
It is mind-boggling.
Because the cons are in control and there's nothing we can do until we get them out?
It's partly because the cons are in control. You had Kevin Shelley, who's been on this program a couple of times, who was the former Secretary of State, who said no machines, so they got rid of him in a real hurry. And they get this other guy in who says, well, we're not going to have any machines, and then kind of quietly in the back channels, well, you know, we'll have a machine here, we'll have a machine there, and pretty soon you got machines. See, it's partly the Republican machine, no pun intended, that's bringing these things in. It's partly that the media in California, just like it is all across the United States, is basically, you know, has the same economic interests as the Republican Party. It's all about plutocracy. It's all about that top, that 99.99th percentile, those people in the United States, the 0.001% of our population who earn more than $6 million a year, who showed more than a 400% increase in their income since George Bush became president, whereas the average working person in America showed an actual decline. Even people making a couple $100,000 showed an actual decline in their income in the United States. It's all about the plutocracy, Eric.
All right. Hey, can I add one more thing?
Sure.
With the brunch with Bernie,
yeah.
I feel Vermont is being selfish and he should go ahead and run for president.
I agree with you. And we're on the air in I believe, 4 radio stations in Vermont, and so they have all heard your words.
All right.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call, and I'll pass along your sentiments to Bernie. It's great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Susan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great. What's up?
Well, got two questions for you. First, similar to the caller before, about what exactly can we do about this voting?
Spread the word far and wide. Go to freepress.org and pull down this story that they just put up there that Wasserman and Fetrakis just wrote, and pass that story out to everybody you know on earth.
And there's nothing that can be done legally against these guys?
Oh, there are legal challenges going on right now. It's just, you know, it's slow and it takes time, and you're fighting against what's essentially a done deal.
Okay, well, is there any chance that if they do find merit in the votes, has there ever been precedent for saying, oops, we were wrong, you know, Bush lost?
No.
And then
no.
They kick him out.
Can't do that. Once he's sworn in, no matter how it happened. And in fact, I mean, this happened once before. There was a president, I'm blanking on which one it was, but one of our presidents clearly was not actually president of the United States. And I would have to, he lost the election, and there was all this, they cut this deals in Congress, and it was a whole, essentially, criminal enterprise. It wasn't Rutherford Hayes. It's happened before. It's happened before. And, you know, it got outed. But still, he was president. So, and it's happened again here. Two elections in a row, George W. Bush. You know, our exit polls were always accurate until the year 2000. Strangest thing. Always accurate, within a point. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I was right in my initial guess. It was Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican who overtly stole an election. And this is just this is now a matter of, you know, American history. 1876 was the election year. And it's really an instructive story for us. It's an interesting little story. Ohio Governor Rutherford, there's that state again. Rutherford B. Hayes was the governor of Ohio. He was, to quote the newspapers of the day, a colorless man who fell like a wet blanket on the party. And he was up against a real firebrand of a guy, Samuel J. Tilden, who was the crime-fighting prosecutor who busted up the Boss Tweed ring in New York, convicted its founder, Boss Tweed, on charges of fraud, bribery, and graft. Keep in mind, this is 1876. And ran on, America very much wanted clean government at that time. This was during Reconstruction. And Tilden ran on the slogan, Tilden and Reform, and he promised to deliver it. Both the campaigns got very negative. We're talking seriously negative. Hayes was accused by the Tilden camp of stealing the pay of dead soldiers in the Civil War, shooting his mother in a fit of insanity, and Tilden was called by the Hayes campaign, Tilden the Democrat was called by the Republican Hayes, a drunkard, a thief, a syphilitic, a liar, and a swindler. And the Democrats and the Republicans in particular tried to portray the Democrats as traitors, since the South was largely Democratic. And, in fact, one of the statements that Hayes made was, every enemy this great republic has had for 20 years has been a Democrat. So every man that Union soldiers shot was a Democrat. Every man that loved slavery better than liberty was a Democrat. The man that assassinated Abraham Lincoln was a Democrat. Every scar you got on your heroic bodies was given you by a Democrat. And, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So anyhow, the election gets down to the wire. And the count, you know, the election happens in November. And the count back in those days took a few days because, of course, they voted, you know, by hand and paper. But it still was the Electoral College, as an earlier caller pointed out. And Tilden won 51% of the popular vote to 47.9% for Hayes. Okay, it was a margin of about 250,000 votes, which was a lot of people back then. Population of the United States was fewer than 100 million at the time. And so when everyone went to bed that night, they figured Tilden was going to be the first Democratic president in over 20 years. Since what would that be? Andrew Jackson, I believe. Anyhow, John C. Reed, here's how it got swung. The New York Times swung the election. The New York Times at that time was a pro-Republican newspaper. I would say they still are, but that's a whole other rant. And when John C. Reed, who was the editor, the managing editor of the New York Times, realized that there were still a couple of states where the returns hadn't come in, Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Oregon, he figured that if he could get the Republicans, regardless of how the vote went in those states, if he could get the Republicans to send electors, then Hayes would win. So he sent a telegram out to the Democratic headquarters, to the Republican headquarters in these three states. Oregon was in the bag. They only had one vote, and it was illegal, actually, but it was a Republican vote. So they knew that they had that one Oregon vote at that time. But Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina together made 19 votes, and so far Tilden only had 184 votes. He needed 185 to win, so he's one electoral vote shy. That's even with Oregon. And so the managing editor of the New York Times sends this thing out to all the Republicans and says, you know, can you pull this thing off? Historian Roy Morris says South Carolina's board, and here's the states that he was sending it to. South Carolina's board, this is who selected the college, the Electoral College. South Carolina's board included three Republicans who were themselves candidates for office. Florida's board was Republican by a 2-to-1 margin, the swing vote in the hands of a former Confederate deserter. Louisiana's board consisted of an undertaker, a saloon keeper, and two thoroughly disreputable carpetbaggers, all who would be indicted for fraud the following year. So the Republicans send out the word. This telegram goes out to all of the Republican parties in these three states. Hayes is elected if we have carried South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. Can you hold your state? Answer immediately. So on the afternoon of November 8, 1876, now keep in mind, America is thinking that Tilden has won the election. Hayes needs one more vote to win, but it looks like Tilden has got it. The Democrats are not going to concede. They refuse to concede the 20 disputed votes. But the Republicans, these three Republican states, they say, yes, we'll send the electors. And riots broke out. There was rioting across the United States because the Republicans were stealing the election on behalf of Hayes. President Grant, who was president at that time, who had wanted, by the way, to run for a third term. This would have been his third term. But his own party wouldn't run him because he was so corrupt. The Republican railroad bribery scandals. He had to send out federal troops to maintain order all across the United States because Democrats were rioting. This then led to a constitutional crisis. As William McFeely writes in his biography of Ulysses S. Grant, the Constitution calls for the electoral votes to be open in the presence of both houses of Congress, but it does not say who would do the counting. If the Republican Senate majority decided the count went one way, and the Democratic majority of the House of Representatives decided it went the other way, you'd have a mess. Another possibility was a Senate filibuster begun before the count could be made that might extend past Grant's last day in office, leaving the United States without a president. People were looking at the possibility of another civil war because the Republicans were actively stealing the election and the Democrats were not going to let them get away with it. Even the Democratic sergeant at arms writes, this is Uncle John's bathroom reader, plunges into the presidency. Even the Democratic sergeant at arms at the House was causing trouble, threatening to deputize 100,000 men and use them to guarantee Tilden's election. Violence actually did erupt in Louisiana, where a Republican candidate for governor was shot and wounded by an outraged Democrat. And in Ohio, someone fired a shot through the window of the Hayes family home when they were sitting for dinner. So Grant thought this was, you know, pretty serious. And finally, in January of 1877, this is just like in January of 2000, you know, it went to the Supreme Court. Well, in this case, both houses of Congress agreed to appoint an independent electoral commission comprised of 5 senators, 5 congressional representatives, and 5 Supreme Court justices. They figured that this would be it. Seven of the members would be Democrats, seven Republicans, and the 15th and tiebreaker would be Supreme Court Chief Justice David Davis of Illinois, who everybody thought was independent. At the last minute, though, the Republicans in the Republican-controlled Illinois legislature held a special election, a one-day election, and elected Justice Davis of the Supreme Court to the U.S. Senate as a Republican. He was the only independent, keep in mind. So he could no longer be on the committee. He was replaced by Justice Joseph Bradley, who was a Republican. And thus, this commission that was now eight Republicans and seven Democrats said that Hayes was the man. They note that didn't stop Tilden's allies from fighting to the bitter end. The House session on March 1st was the stormiest in history. Roy Morris writes, members roared with disapproval as House Speaker Samuel Randall, a former Tilden supporter, Tilden the Democrat, who actually won, stymied all efforts to stop the vote. Some congressmen waved pistols. One climbed atop his desk, screaming with anger. Oaths and insults filled the air. Finally, after 18 tumultuous hours, the session ended with a telegram from Tilden graciously requesting that the vote be completed. Tilden did what John Kerry did and said, hey, knock it off. Enough. He knew that he must accept the Electoral Commission's result or risk the nation erupting into civil war. So Hayes, 185 votes. Tilden, 184 votes. Hayes did not, he was called his fraudulency. Instead of being called President Hayes, he was referred to as his fraudulency and Rutherford B. Hayes, 19th President of the United States. So it's not the first time a Republican has stolen the White House. And, hopefully, however, it'll be the last. Jim in Monroe, Washington. Hey, Jim, we've got about a minute. What's up?
I wanted to know if, first of all, thank you for having me on, but if they could have a recall election on Gray Davis in California, why can't they recall the Secretary of State in Ohio?
I don't know. I don't know Ohio law well enough to know the answer to that question. I know that the Ohio Constitution provides for impeachment and that Ken Blackwell could be impeached, but that would require the House of Representatives and the Senate in Ohio to do that, and they're both in the hands of Republicans. Last time I looked, I may be wrong, but I believe that they are. So I doubt that's going to happen. And in fact, now Ken Blackwell is running for governor in Ohio, and if he can keep these 308,000 Democrats off the voter rolls, he may win. And that's where it gets really bizarre. The guy, just like Kathleen Harris, the woman who helped steal the election for George W. Bush in 2000, ended up in the U.S. Senate. Now we've got, Ken Blackwell, who helped him steal the election in 2004, going to become governor.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it, Jim? Welcome to the mind-boggling age of corruption. Like I said, it's not new. It happened back in 1876 with Tilden and Hayes. In surprisingly similar fashion. It's not new, but that doesn't make it any less distasteful. And all the more reason, frankly, for us to speak out. And at least back then, the Democrats stood up and said, no! 16 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome to your line at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. By the way, just a heads up, House Resolution H.R. 4167, the Food Uniformity Act, is slowly grinding its way through Congress. Probably going to come up for a vote next week. This is a law that would essentially say that the federal government is the sole arbiter of how food is labeled. And over 100 various state laws that have to do with labeling of foods from saying, hey, this food was actually made here in this state, to, hey, this food may contain RGBH or some other sort of genetically modified organism, all those laws would be struck down by this. This is the wet dream of the giant agribiz industry. And it has a majority of the members of the House of Representatives as sponsors. virtually all the Republicans and a good chunk of well-greased Democrats. And so call your member of Congress. The toll-free is 888-355-3588. This is not in the Senate yet, so you want to ask for your member of the House of Representatives, 888-355-3588, and say that you are opposed to the Food Uniformity Act. You are opposed to the Food Uniformity Act. And because this is just a power grab by these big multinational corporations who don't want you and me to know what's in our food. And it's wrong. It's just plain old wrong. And if you don't know who your member of Congress is, if you don't know who represents you in the House of Representatives, when you call that number, 888-355-3588, just give me your zip code and they'll be able to tell you who it is. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is with us. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. Hey, Victoria, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Yes, this particular bill, which they're saying that the interest of changing the food standards is because of uniformity, so it will be less confusing if, for example, you go from Missouri to Texas or Tennessee and your food standards labeling will all be the same and you won't get confused. That's the reason that they're giving for this.
Yeah, and it's BS. When I was living in Vermont, Ben and Jerry's, way back in the old days, back 8, 10 years ago, something like that, when Ben and Jerry's was owned by Ben and Jerry, they put on their labels that they were only buying their milk from local Vermont farmers who did not use bovine growth hormone, RGBH, mm-hmm. and which of course Monsanto makes. And the Monsanto got all into it, and the federal government came in and said, you can't put that on your label. And they said, wait a minute, we're not saying there's something in our food. We're saying there's something not in our food. And the government said, that'll confuse consumers. You got to take that off your label.
They
had like a 3-4 year legal battle over this thing.
No, did they win?
Well, ultimately the law got changed, and so they are allowed to say that there's no RGBH in their ice cream, but they also have to say, and by the way, the RGBH is just wonderful stuff, no problem.
It is fascinating because it, all over the food in the UK, as you know, are all the labels saying the things that are not in it.
Oh yeah, well that's because in Europe you have the precautionary principle and you have actual consumer friendly legislatures who haven't been totally bought out by large agribiz concerns. What we have in the United States ever since the Buckley versus Viejo court decision, and I'm going to get into this rant, after we finish talking with this whole thing with the Vermont campaign reforms, we've had two Supreme Court decisions, Buckley versus Viejo and First National Bank Boston versus Bilotti, that essentially said that money is the same thing as speech and the corporations are the same thing as people and they can spend all the money they want because they don't have a mouth. And the result has been that Washington, D.C. has come to resemble something closer to a bordello than a seat of government.
Well, as somebody who lives here, I can say that's true, although they're just not nearly as well dressed as they would be in the average bordello.
Yes, yeah, and I didn't mean that as an insult to the bordellos.
I understand.
I have a lot of respect for the world's oldest profession.
Yes.
In any case, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, nothing as exciting as that. Well, basically, people are just simply reacting to the video showing the president being briefed by Brownie and others on the upcoming hurricane, the video showing that clearly they knew how bad it was going to be. Michael Brown now saying, basically, I told you so. I told you it was going to be a big one. I told you that I knew what I was doing. He says, I'm glad it's coming out because despite the media reports and the general public perception that I was a dummy, that I didn't know what I was doing, I knew exactly what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brownie actually looks in this video like he is doing a heck of a job.
Well,
it's Bush who's asleep at the switch.
It looks as though he is asleep at the switch. The weather people certainly look as though they're awake. Chertoff doesn't look as though he's terribly engaged. It is a disturbing video. And now, it's also coming out now, and I think there's going to have to be a bit more research done on this before we can be sure of anything one way or the other. But it seems as though the media may have had this video for 6 months.
Right, and sat on it.
Shown it, yes.
And that's, which raises a whole other set of questions. This department briefings are routinely recorded. Homeland Security does not know how the AP got the footage. It was obtained that day or the day after, though, by a network and a cable affiliate, neither aired it. So why did they sit on this thing?
I mean, why did they
was it Fox News that got it?
they had to know during the time of the hurricane that it was a big story.
You would think.
Too explosive.
You would think. I don't know. That's going to be an interesting one. That's a story about the media that the media is going to cover. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yes, it will.
Indeed. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with
us
today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. It's the Tom Hartman Program. That's me. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, and I wonder, yes, I wonder.
Welcome back, my friends, in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain here in the Tom Hartman radio program. George W. Bush has created a new Office of Iranian Affairs. Now, if this isn't deja vu all over again, I don't know what is. The Bush administration this month quietly orchestrated a major shift in U.S. policy toward Iran, requesting $85 million for a plan not just to contain Tehran's nuclear ambitions, but also to topple the Iranian government. An unclassified State Department, this is from the Center for American Progress, an unclassified State Department cable released yesterday offers details on this new strategy. Cable announces a new Office of Iranian Affairs and serves as a global casting call for Iran and Persian language experts. It states that the U.S. is establishing positions in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and developing a reporting position in countries with large Iranian exile communities, including Germany, Great Britain, and Azerbaijan, among others, a strategy identical to that used prior to the war in Iraq. At the same time, the Hudson Institute, conservative think tank, has published a commentary urging the Bush administration to use an American military strike to knock out Iran's uranium processing capability. Herb London of the Hudson Institute says, will Bush do it? He cannot afford not to do it. Oh, my. Now, we look at that, and then we go back and we look at what Bush was told about Iraq. This from Murray Wass in the National Journal, just out. I mean, literally, just out, published today, two highly classified intelligence reports delivered directly to President Bush before the Iraq war cast doubt on key public assertions made by the president and by Dick Cheney. Now, this was delivered to George Bush in October of 2002, a one-page summary of the National Intelligence Estimate. It was about high-strength aluminum tubes. The report said that the Energy Department and the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research believed that the tubes were intended for conventional weapons. See, these were tubes that were used to make rockets. Bush was himself informed of the Department of Energy and the Secretary of State's dissents and the first evidence that the president himself knew of the sharp debate within the government over the aluminum tubes. And yet, what did George W. Bush say to us?
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons.
Why?
If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
So that's what Bush told us. But the truth is that Bush himself was informed. I'm hearing a crunching sound. It's really weird. Bush himself was informed that that these aluminum tubes were for conventional weapons. I mean, he just made this up. The report stated that U.S. intelligence agencies unanimously agreed that it was unlikely that Saddam would try to attack the United States, except if ongoing military operations risk the imminent demise of his regime. In other words, if we attacked him, or if he intended to exact revenge for such an assault. Now, this is just now coming out. On at least four earlier occasions, beginning in the spring of 2002, according to the same records and sources, the president was informed during his morning intelligence briefings of the U.S. intelligence agencies believed that it was unlikely that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat to the United States. So he was told that Saddam was not a threat to the United States.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
He was told that in all probability, Saddam Hussein had gotten rid of his weapons of mass destruction, as the UN weapons inspectors had found. After all, the UN's weapons inspectors were running around saying, you know, you can believe that they're there. People believe in witches, but that doesn't mean that they're there.
In the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But, as Hans Blix said, he didn't have that evidence, and there was no evidence. And, in fact, now we find out in 2002, even before the invasion, that there was no evidence. And yet, what did Bush say?
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
It is seeking nuclear weapons. He continues.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history.
Now, this is where Bush conflates 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. And this is why 85% of our troops in Iraq think that the reason they're there is to punish Saddam Hussein for 9/11, even though he had nothing to do with it.
On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
Now, Bush, we are discovering from this report in the National Journal and in other sources, a whole variety of sources now, this is well known, Bush was informed clearly, explicitly, unambiguously that Iraq represented no threat to the United States. In fact, if you go back to January, February, and March of 2001, when the Bush administration first took office, you can find the quotes of Condi Rice and Colin Powell in public, in response to questions, saying, we've got Saddam in a box, we've got him where we want him, he represents no threat to us. And Bush was being told, I'm sorry, there is no threat from Saddam Hussein. 9 years of sanctions have crippled him. He's got 500,000 people a year dying of starvation and diseases associated with a lack of chlorine for water purification, because we won't sell him chlorine because he could use it to make poison gas. So even the water supplies in Baghdad are contaminated with water from the Euphrates River. And people are, you know, children are dying of diarrheal disease. 500,000 a year. This guy, we've bombed his Air Force into dust. It's smithereens. There's nothing left. He tried to hide some planes in the desert, which completely ruined them. He's got nothing. He's got nothing. And so Bush comes out and says,
first, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And now we have Mr. Friendly. I mean, Mr. Green Jeans. You got Garrison Keillor out there. You go to commondreams.org today. Garrison Keillor calling for the impeachment of the President of the United States. Why? Because he lied us into a war in which several thousand Americans are dead. Tens of thousands of Americans are wounded. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis are dead. The world is contaminated so heavily by depleted uranium that they found spikes of uranium levels in the air over Great Britain a week after the bombing that was going on in Iraq. Uranium levels so high in that part of the country that they had to declare a public health alert. And Bush,
if we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, Does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
Oh, yeah, no, this is a terrible thing. We've discovered, we saw from an aerial photograph that Uday and Kusei had a model airplane. They had this balsa wood airplane with about a 12-foot wingspan that might be could have flown, a mile, on one of these little gas engines. You know, these remote control airplanes? And so Bush blew that picture up and said, we got to worry about this. This is serious stuff, you know. This is dangerous.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
And let's not forget about those model airplanes.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yeah, we're going to take he's going to take Uday and Kusei's balsam wood airplane, and they're going to load it up with this with these aluminum tubes and other nuclear devices, and maybe throw a little anthrax in, and they're going to fly that thing all the way over to the United States, at 35, 40 miles an hour. It's only going to take 4 or 5 days, but we can't stop it. We don't have any missiles. We don't have any jets. We don't have any fight. After all, we couldn't stop the 9/11 hijackers. They were in the air for 3 hours. The Bush administration is now making the argument that they are incompetent. You find Republicans on all the talking head shows going, oh, well, he was just incompetent. They don't use that word, but, oh, well, he missed something, incompetent. I'm sorry. This is somewhere between criminal negligence and intent. The evidence now is that Bush and Cheney had contrary information and they lied because they wanted a war. That's impeachable, my friends. 45 minutes beyond the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. And Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts. I'm assuming listening on our new affiliate is at WHMP, WMHP?
Yeah. Sometimes streaming. How are you doing, Tom?
I am great, Steve. What's up?
Listen, I just think that so many people are so hopelessly infected with this conflation of Saddam and Osama of Iraq and other entities, that I think it's really important to emphasize as impeachable the diversion of enormous military and other resources from the effort in Afghanistan to continually ask the question. I mean, I hate to get into that, but if you want to give it as a given, okay, Saddam was half the problem. How come you are completely neglecting getting the other half of the problem? I hate to put it that way because we know Saddam wasn't half the problem. I'm talking about the 9/11 thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's very, very important to emphasize as impeachable the diversion of the enormous diversion of military from Afghanistan, our total abandonment of that effort, our abandonment of our effort to get Osama, that's criminal and impeachable, and also our continued cooperation with the nations of the Arabian Peninsula and our lack, I'm not saying our continued cooperation 100% is a bad thing, but I'm saying to turn a to
blind eye, I think, is the cliche you're looking for.
Thank you, and to thank you very much. to look at the total lack of intelligence resources, possibly military resources,
sure,
directed at the nations of the Arabian Peninsula.
Well, here's the reality, Steve.
Where the Al-Qaeda philosophy has its spiritual...
Yeah, absolutely, which is Saudi Arabia. That's where the, you know, good old Mr. Waha back in the 1930s was a Saudi, and he cut a deal with the Saudi royal family that basically, you know, in the best of Marxist principles, he said, I'll create the religion that will be the opium for the masses, and you keep political power, and I'll keep religious power, and we'll feed each other. And Wahhabism was born, and Osama bin Laden, of course, is a Wahhabist. And that's why Saddam Hussein would have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, because he saw them as a threat to his power. He
right.
was a secularist.
Right.
Now, here's the interesting thing about Afghanistan. 90, and this is, you know, very rarely discussed in the press. I saw one mention yesterday of it in the media. Here's George W. Bush. He's in Afghanistan yesterday. And 90% of the world's opium is now being grown in Afghanistan. Last year, Afghanistan produced the largest opium crop in the history of the planet. In 1 year, Afghanistan produced more opium than the entire planet has ever produced in the history of the planet.
Yeah.
And where is that opium ending up? It's ending up mostly in Europe as heroin. A lot of it's coming to the United States, by the way, as heroin. And, you know, we think that, you know, the GIs coming back from Vietnam had a heroin problem. This is going to be, well, we'll see what happens with the GIs in Iraq. But right now what you've got is a bunch of European countries who are freaking out at George Bush because heroin on the streets in Frankfurt, Germany is now $2 and $3 a hit. And 10 years ago, it was $30 a hit. There weren't many heroin addicts, and now they're having an epidemic of heroin addiction in Europe, the same way that we're having an epidemic of meth addiction here.
Tom, I think it's also important to note the UAE ports deal at this time, and I think it's important to note that, you know, the nations, all those nations of the Arabian Peninsula were seriously worried about Saddam Hussein, and I think it's important to note how cozy we are with them.
Actually, I don't think that they were seriously worried about it, Steve. Steve, hang on just a second. I don't think that they were that seriously worried about him. You had Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, saying, if you go after Saddam, you will create 1,000 bin Ladens. You had the UAE saying, you had the entire Arab League refusing to participate in any sort of coordinated activity against Saddam. They knew that Saddam was in a box. They didn't like him. They didn't like the fact that he was secularist. They didn't like the fact that he was belligerent. They didn't like the fact that he took on one of their crowd, a royal family in Kuwait. They didn't like any of that, but they knew that he was in a box. They didn't view him as a threat, and he wasn't a threat. And in fact, he was holding together these three disparate, you know, elements in Iraq that now are exploding. Steve, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. I hope you call again. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, we got about a minute left. What's up?
3 points. Plus, Saddam served our interest when he made a lot of millionaires, billionaires when we sold him arms.
Oh, yeah. Saddam was our friend. We put him into power.
And
we put him into power for that reason, to stabilize the region.
Let me say two other quick points. One is, why does Bush sound like the snake on the Jungle Book when he's lying, the hissing? And two, the media made Saddam for 13 years. We kept getting interrupted, the Americans and everybody, for 13 years. They made him the fly at the picnic.
Saddam?
Yeah, for 13 years. Remember, the Iraqis invaded the no-fly zone today, and Saddam...
For
13 years, they got into the minds of these brain-dead zombies that believe anything.
Yeah, he was the convenient guy to kick around.
He was the fly at the picnic.
Yeah. Yeah, well said, Armin. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Just about out of time here, Karen. What's up? We are out of time. You can have the last sentence.
Last sentence?
Sure.
Okay.
You got to spit it out, though.
Oh.
Okay, I'll give it to George W. Bush instead, then. Karen, thanks for the call. We'll talk to you again on another day.
Facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
There you go. 57 minutes past the hour. National Journal. New evidence that Bush knew Saddam represented no threat. 2,300 people dead now from the United States.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the real free speech zone. No barbed wire fences, no passes required from the RNC. It's 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Herman Cain is with us. He is the host of the nationally syndicated Herman Cain program, the Herman Cain Show, and president of THE New Voice, Inc., a business and leadership consulting company specializing in keynote speaking and inspirational publications. Herman Cain, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm enjoying being on. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. And your website, by the way, Herman Cain, HermanCain.com for people who want more information. Herman, you wrote recently that the United States is drifting away from capitalism and its free market foundations toward a gutless brand of socialism.
Yes.
What is that?
That means that we've gotten away from those fundamental principles that our founding fathers founded this country on. And the reason that I call it gutless socialism, Tom, is because we have lost a lot of our liberties because of the tax code. We are forced to contribute money to a dysfunctional social security structure, and government spending is simply out of control.
Okay, let's take a couple of these, you know, one at a time. First of all, Social Security, to the best of my knowledge, has never failed to miss a payment. I can't say the same for example, the insurance companies down in Louisiana that Trent Lott is having to sue.
Yep, you're right.
How is Social Security dysfunctional?
Because in the year 2015, there will be more money paid out than money that's going in.
But you realize in 1982, Ronald Reagan doubled the Social Security tax so that the baby boomer generation would be the first and only generation that would not only pay for their parents' retirement, but would pay for their own.
Well,
and then he began borrowing that money.
Well, Congress started borrowing that money because that took an act of Congress. President Reagan did not do that by himself. Now, my point is, in the year 2015, you're going to have more money being paid out under the current formulas than money that's coming in. That means, Tom, that the only option that our Congress, who has demonstrated this in the past, they're going to come back and say, we have to raise taxes and we have to reduce benefits. We cannot continue to do this indefinitely, and that's why I say the system is dysfunctional.
But Herman Cain, let's be honest with the American people. The Social Security up until 1982 had been a complete pay-as-you-go program. 100% of the money that came in every year was what got paid out.
That's right.
More or less.
Yes.
In 1982, they said, okay, we're going to have this rabbit going through the python, right? The baby boomer generation.
Right.
It's only going to last for about 25 years, and then they'll all be dead. And so what we're going to do is we're going to create a trust fund. We're going to set aside about $1 trillion. We're going to set aside a whole pile of money so that these people, the baby boomers, are not only going to be paying for their parents' retirement like every other generation before them had, they're also going to pay for their own retirement.
Okay.
And then when they're all dead, we're going to go back to being
the way. That's not what happened. That is not what happened.
What the Moynihan Greenspan Commission came up with. Wait a minute.
Here's what happened to that may have happened, but let me tell you what messed up the program. What messed up the program was the fact that they took the Social Security dollars and made it part of the General Treasury such that the Social Security dollars became part of
I agree, and Ronald
jar.
Reagan did that at the suggestion of Alan Greenspan because trickle-down economics and Reagan's tax cuts didn't work. They threw this country into a recession. They threw the budget into a deficit, and Reagan's looking around going, holy cow, I thought if I cut taxes, the revenue would go up. It didn't go up. What am I going to do? And Greenspan tells him, and this is documented by Ravi Batra.
Take chill pill. You're absolutely wrong again, okay? From 1950 up until 1980, before Reagan took office, Tom, okay, we were having less revenue. The deficit was getting worse. When Reagan took over and he cut the tax...
We have had a deficit in this country, Herman Cain, since the founding of this country.
The revenue started to go up. That's when we were able to get out of the recession. And ever since 1980, we've had the best economic news. We've had the best economy overall in the last...
Herman Cain, we never had a $1 trillion deficit until Reagan came into office. Ronald Reagan borrowed more money than every other president in the history of the United States combined, and we are this year going to spend $160 billion in interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed so he could make the economy sort of look like it maybe be, you know, was okay and get us out of the Reagan recession.
Well, Tom, you know, I have a lot of respect for you, but you got your facts wrong. That is simply not the case. And, you know, that is simply
how much was the debt? How much was the United States deficit, the United States debt when Reagan came into office?
I don't have that number on the tip of my tongue.
It was around $870 billion, less than a trillion. You know what it was when Reagan left office?
The important thing.
Do you know what it was when Reagan left office?
The important thing is
it was $3.2 trillion.
Now, Tom, it may have been $2.2 trillion, but you
give me a $2 trillion credit card, Herman Cain. I'll show you what it looks like to live large.
That totaled on Ronald Reagan, okay?
I'm placing it all on Ronald Reagan.
Well, I think that is wrong.
And then George Herbert Walker Bush and then Bill Clinton, although Bill Clinton, to his credit, in the last couple of years of his administration reversed this, but he did it with not one single vote from Republicans in Congress, and now George W. Bush even worse. And I'm not saying this as a partisan. You want to let's criticize Bill Clinton line. I'll be at the front of the line. I think he sold this country out with NAFTA and GATT. But Reagan sold us out and destroyed Social Security in the process by taking Greenspan's advice. You ought to read Ravi Batra's book, Greenspan's Fraud. He lays the whole thing out. It's brilliant. Or it's in the Wall Street Journal, for God's sake, laid this stuff out just a month ago. Herman?
You know, you've got several sources that you're referring to, but then I can't counter those sources because, quite frankly, I didn't know that you wanted to refer to those.
Okay, well let's move along. Let's just agree to disagree about Social Security and Ronald Reagan. You're talking about gutless socialism. I'm wondering are you opposed to the socialist police departments?
I'm opposed to is the fact that government is getting bigger and bigger. And we have a dysfunctional Social Security system. You don't agree with me, but there's also a report that was generated by the Social Security Administration that said that we cannot remain solvent. And when you get your statement every year, if you happen to be of the age where you might draw Social Security, they even tell you on the front page that it's going to run out of money if we don't change things.
I understand, Herman, that the Bush administration is using the Social Security.
Herman,
I'm giving you this.
Let's fix the problem.
Herman, I'm giving you this.
All right.
You and I have a difference of opinion about how the problem started and what the solution is. I think the solution is really easy. Let's just make it a flat tax. I don't understand why I'm paying this year the exact same amount of Social Security tax that Bill Gates paying. I don't understand that.
Well,
if we made it a flat tax, it would solve the problem. But, you know, you and I have a difference of opinion on this, but you made this larger global statement, and we've only got about 2.5 minutes left here. You made this global statement that America's drifting into socialism, and I'm curious about what the socialist programs are you don't like.
Okay,
do you dislike our socialist police and fire departments?
Okay, I will tell you. I call it gutless socialism because those, you know, some members of Congress won't be honest and tell you that that's what they want to do. They are basically following the Communist Manifesto about taking from those that have the greatest and giving it to those that have.
Well, hang on, just a second. In the Communist Manifesto,
my second point is
let's just deal with this first. In the Communist Manifesto, Herman Cain, they suggest that the government.
People in position.
Herman, this is not the Sean Hannity show. Give me a chance to talk, would you, Herman? I give you a chance to talk. Let me get a sentence in here, would you? In the Communist Manifesto, the suggestion is that the government should own the means of production and supply. The last time I looked around, the government in the United States is not nationalizing all of our companies.
They're nationalizing our money. They're nationalizing our income. Did you know, Tom,
that
if you look at the amount of taxes paid, I just did this calculation only 5 minutes before I got on the phone. If you look at someone who's making, say, that magical $90,000 that you have to pay your Social Security tax on plus Medicare, that's 15.3%. And if you're making $90,000 or somewhere between 50 and 90, I guess you can call that middle class, then you're in the 28% bracket. That means that 43% of your money is being taxed right off the top, and that doesn't include states. Now, most of the states have a state income tax. That means that most people are paying over 50% of every dollar they earn for dysfunctional government programs. That's why I called it gutless socialism.
So, okay, we get up in the morning and we brush our teeth with water that is fresh and pure because government programs made it that way. We drive on public streets that are paid for by government programs. We're safe from crime because of the socialist police departments. Where our house isn't going to burn down because we have a socialist fire department. Our kids go to public schools because we have socialist schools. I don't get at what you're opposed to here.
What I'm opposed to is the inefficiency in some of these programs. See,
name
you,
one.
You extrapolated calling it.
Name one.
Police, socialist fire, socialist schools. No,
it is. By your definition, it is.
You have a government monopoly. It's not going to work efficiently. I'm opposed to the inefficiency and the.
So you think we should privatize our fire departments?
Right.
We should privatize our fire departments.
I think our fire departments work just fine. I don't have a beef with the fire departments.
But wait a minute. That's a government monopoly.
I know it's a government monopoly, but that happens to be one that's working pretty
so
good.
So some government monopolies are okay.
The only one that's working well is the United States military, and we should all be thankful that we have one of the best militaries in the world. I'm not saying – I'm not against the amount of money we spend on military.
But they're privatizing our military, Herman.
Is our number one – national defense should be our number one priority.
And that's
our number one priority.
And you are of the opinion that if we the people collectively decide that we want to have some sort of social safety net, that that's socialism, we shouldn't do it.
Not if it's going to be inefficient and people aren't going to get a return on their money.
Okay. Well, you speak well. I appreciate it. It's good to talk with somebody who gives as well as he gets. HermanCain.com, the website, Herman Cain, The Herman Cain Show, and THE New Voice Incorporated. Good talking with you, Herman.
Take care.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Here's the news, coming to you every hour on the hour.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where liberals fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a decent and functioning social security system. Herman gets, well, we won't pick on Herman. Joe Republican gets up at 6 a.m. to prepare his morning coffee, fills his pot full of good, clean drinking water because some liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. He takes his daily medication with his first swallow of coffee. His medications are safe to take because some liberal fought to ensure their safety and work as advertised. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance. Now Joe gets it too, even though he's not a union member, because his employer needs to offer competitive benefits to hire the best people. Joe prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs this day. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. He takes his morning shower, reaches for his shampoo. His bottle is properly labeled with every ingredient and the amount of its contents because some liberal fought for his right to know what he's putting on his body and how much it contained. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some tree-hugging liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He drives to work in one of the safest cars in the world because some liberal fought to raise safety standards and emission controls. Joe begins his workday. He's got a good pay with good job with good pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation because some liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. Joe's employer pays these standards because Joe's employer doesn't want to deal with the possibility that the liberals are going to come and get him. Joe's hurt in the job or becomes unemployed. He'll get workers' compensation or unemployment check because some liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of his temporary misfortune. It's noontime. Joe needs to go to the bank to deposit his paycheck so he can pay some bills. His deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC up to $100,000 because some liberal wanted to protect the middle class and their money from greedy, unscrupulous bankers like the ones who ruined the banking system during the Republican Great Depression. Joe needs to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. Joe is home from work. He plans to visit his father this evening at his farm home in the country. He arrives at his boyhood home. He was the third generation to live in the house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't make rural loans. House didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Those rural Republicans might otherwise still be sitting in the dark. He's happy to see his dad, who's now retired. His dad lives on Social Security and his union pension because some liberal made sure that he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. After his visit with Dad, Joe gets in his car for the ride home. He turns on a radio talk show. The host keeps saying that liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't tell Joe that his beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys through his day. Joe agrees. We don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just because I have. Just like I have. Excuse me. Yeah, we probably also, as Tom from Minnesota notes, we probably also should remind a Joe Republican that it was a liberal named Franklin Roosevelt who led the free world's armies to defeat right-wing fascism in World War II and saved democracy, so that Joe has the freedom to be misled by that guy on the radio. Oh, yeah, that liberal also saved the market economy from the Republican Great Depression that he inherited from those guys named Coolidge and Hoover. Look it up in the encyclopedia. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our telephone number. And Claire in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Claire, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You're doing a great job. As the father of an autistic child who is painfully concerned with food purity and labeling, I would like to know what happened to the Republican principle of favoring states' rights over federal power. Does that go out the window when they have their corporate masters to serve?
The Republican principle of states' rights.
Yeah, I thought they had one of those.
Let me finish.
Seems to evaporate.
Yeah, the Republican principle of states' rights was only a principle of states' rights during the 1960s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when the Democrats decided that they were no longer going to be the party of racism, and so the Republicans, with Nixon's Southern strategy, stepped into that fold. It used to be that the Democrats back in the 20s and 30s and 40s used states' rights as the argument for Jim Crow laws and things, and then the Republicans picked up that mantra. It's always been code for racism, basically.
And the most honest political statement of that time was when Lyndon Johnson turned to Bill Moyers when they signed the Civil Rights Act and said, Bill, we've just given away the South for every election for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, Bill Moyers actually told me that story in person. He said to Lyndon Johnson, he said, if you sign that bill, you're gonna give away, the Democratic Party is gonna lose for at least a generation. And Lyndon Johnson said, if that's the price we have to pay, it's worth it. That's how Bill Moyers told me the story. In fact, on this program, he told that story.
And Johnson knew what the score was. He was the ultimate vote counter.
There you go. There
God
you
bless
go.
The guy.
Yeah. Amen. He was one of our greatest presidents. If he hadn't had the Vietnam War and gone off on that weird adventure, he would probably be remembered as one of our greatest presidents. It's a shame that he did. Claire, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no!
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
So you think you could tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail?
Well, some folks actually have it all figured out.
If it feels good, do it. And if you've got a problem, blame it on somebody else.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. No, that's not my advice. It's definitely not my advice. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The right starting to splinter. The Reich is beginning to splinter. You have the old-fashioned, principled conservatives. I disagree with many of their ideas. The idea that aristocracy is better than democracy, for example. But they at least have the power of their conviction. They understand the principles that underlie their positions. This is one of the problems that I have with a lot of liberal progressives and a lot of so-called conservatives, is that people simply, they just grab onto positions. They say, oh, well, I'm in favor of this, or I'm opposed to that, or I'm in favor of this, and there's not a coherent philosophy behind it, a coherent worldview. Well, George Will has a coherent worldview. It's a conservative worldview. It's consistent with, Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, with Barry Goldwater in the 60s, with Sir Edmund Burke in the 1790s. I mean, he has a it's consistent. And George Will has now come out and said, and I quote, "Terrorism is not the only new danger of this era. Another is the Bush administration's argument that because the president is commander-in-chief, he is the, quote, sole organ for the nation in foreign affairs," end quote. That non sequitur, George Will says, or writes, is refuted by the Constitution's plain language, which empowers Congress to ratify treaties, declare war, fund and regulate military forces, and make laws necessary and proper for the execution of all presidential powers. In other words, all presidential power derives from the Congress, not from George Bush saying that he's got it, it's his. On the other hand, Herbert London, president of the conservative Hudson Institute, came out today suggesting that the Bush administration should use an American military strike to knock out Iran's uranium processing capacity without a declaration of war from Congress. As Herbert London writes, "Any way you cut it, military force seems like the most likely stratagem for success. Will Bush do it? He cannot afford not to do it. His legacy cannot be a nuclear Iran prepared to destabilize all the Middle East and possibly Europe. This is yet another test of American will." Yeah, right. There is no military solution for the issues in Iran. As retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Sam Gardner said, a simulations expert from the U.S. Army's National War College, by the way, after leading a war game in Iran, he said, "After all this effort, I'm left with two simple sentences for policymakers. Number one, you have no military solution for the issues of Iran. Number two, you must make diplomacy work." John Kennedy understood that. Lyndon Johnson understood that. Richard Nixon understood that. George W. Bush, not the brightest bulb on the tree. Lou at Everett, Washington. Hey, Lou, welcome to the program. Hey, Lou.
Good morrow. Sorry, been on hold a while.
That's quite all right. What's up?
Well, let's see now. To start with, I would really appreciate if someone could dig out. There were 27 senior CIA analysts who quit during June, July, and August of 2002 rather than sign on to the Declaration of War reports that were being ramrodded by Cheney and Dumsfeld.
Right.
Okay. Number two is listening to you while I was waiting. You know, the issue isn't socialism. The issue is where socialism is.
Well, really the issue is how do you define socialism? I mean,
most
dictionaries.
I live in Boeing land. Boeing has never developed an airplane that wasn't paid for through the military program. The 747, which was the main airplane I grew up with in development, was originally their entrance into the C-5 contest.
Right.
The plant in Everett where Boeing assembles their airplanes, they don't build them anymore, they only assemble them, was an old Nike site and the Painfield Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And that land was given to Boeing, and the buildings built and the tooling put in it under the C-5 program. And if you go through, that's been true throughout. In the mid-1980s, the Air Force funded an initiative called the Factory of the Future, and that built most of the major corporate manufacturing facilities in the U.S., and now they're being shut down and shipped to China.
Right. So, in other words, your point is that what Herman Cain is calling socialism is, on the one hand, probably the largest recipients of this socialism have been corporations that he's so decrying. And,
yeah, well, I mean,
and number two, it ain't really socialism.
Yeah, well, we cannot have an air transport system unless we subsidize it.
Yeah.
The
same is true of railroads.
If you actually had the costs of an air transport system, it would be financially unsustainable.
Right, just the TSA's budget. Just the people who are frisking Granny. Their budget last year was larger than the budget of the FBI.
Right.
And the airlines are not paying for that, you and I are.
Right.
And that's a direct subsidy to the airline industry.
Right. And then the whole thing about 9/11. Prior to, you know, 9 a.m. Eastern time, the 11th of September 2001, if you were on an airplane that was hijacked, the point of the exercise was to shut up, keep your head down, and wait it out. That was what all the domain knowledge had taught.
Mm-hmm.
And the passengers on the first three planes understood that the hijackers are going to make silly statements, they're going to kill one or two people to prove they're serious, and then they're going to land somewhere, and you're going to have to wait it out.
Right.
That was the entire history.
As had always happened in the past, yeah.
That's what always happened.
They're going to take it to
past.
Cuba or
that
something.
That was the domain knowledge.
Right.
The fourth airplane, the passengers found out what had happened. They pulled their pocket knives, and they attacked the hijackers.
Right.
We have now disarmed the passengers and put them in airplanes, and I'm not going to tell anyone the details of it, but there are explosive devices on every commercial airplane in the air that someone who is absolutely bare naked and has a minimum of knowledge of the subject can ignite.
Oh, yeah. They're devices that are used to deploy the oxygen. But the fact that...
No, those aren't explosive.
I see. Okay. Well,
I'm not going to tell you, but...
Yeah, well, that's fine. Yeah, don't. But the point is, Lou, with regard to the airplanes, that this is all, show. I mean, this is a very, very simple show. Back in the 70s, when we were having hijackers hijacking planes to go to Cuba, the federal government proposed that the airlines, the executive, I forget who was president at the time, I think it might have been Nixon even, proposed that the airlines all harden their cockpit doors because El Al had been doing that for about a decade and they had not had a hijacking.
Right, but.
And the airlines, through their lobby, lobbied Congress to stop that legislation to force them to harden their cockpit doors.
No, that went through for 2 years and then they took it down because it cost a little over $14,000 a year to carry a pound of mass that doesn't otherwise work.
So we actually had hardened doors for a couple of years?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, in any case,
at one of my tours of duty at Boeing was involved taking them out in order to save money for the airlines because a pound of mass on an airplane costs $14,000 a year.
In fuel. Yeah.
The bottom line here is
if we had simply stuck with that, you know, right now we have hardened cockpit doors. There's no way a hijacker is going to get in now. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, and so we're going through this whole song and dance. I mean, it is all for show. It is all for show. Lou,
well,
I appreciate
it. Down. It's not a problem.
Yeah, I understand. But, you know, that if they're going to come after us, I have a feeling that, you know, they've done that. They've been there and done that, and they're going to come up with something else.
Right. If you really want to stop the problem, hand everybody who gets on the plane a single shot, soft bullet, target pistol.
Yeah. No
one bullet's going to kill anybody.
There you go. Yeah, now we're back to the theory of an armed society is a polite society. But you make your point is an interesting one, and I appreciate it. Lou, thank you very much for calling, and thanks for holding on as long as you did. Lou, Judy in Dana Point, California. Judy, we have about a minute. What's up?
Yeah, I just want to comment on the Social Security. I got in late, so I don't know if this has been stated. But if they just stopped taking from the trust fund, the Social Security would be solvent.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's been true since Reagan.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a joke. I mean, it's just a mess. I really feel that whatever they do, I don't trust them, and that the brain power in Washington is so low that I wouldn't trust anything they came up with. I mean, it would probably be a disaster like everything else they touch.
Yeah, well said, Judy. Well said. Okay. You know, it's just what's absolutely amazing to me was that the only national politician to have told the truth about this and spoken honestly about it was Al Gore during the 2000 election.
Exactly.
And I
voted for him.
Yeah, and he talked about the lockbox for the Social Security Trust Fund, and I doubt that 1% of Americans had any idea what he was talking about.
Oh, of course not. I mean, I don't think half of them read anything.
Well, no, I mean, they didn't know about it because basically Reagan started borrowing, Bush continued borrowing, and Clinton, for that matter, continued borrowing, and it was like a conspiracy of silence among all these guys.
Exactly.
Judy, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. We've got to take a break here. It's the time. Tom Hartman radio program where being progressive never felt so good.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you're so down-hearted and misunderstood, just over and over and over you heard. Yeah. Hold on tight to your dream.
There you go, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Hang on tight to your dreams. Indeed. Welcome back to our program. It is absolutely amazing out there. Bush at the... this is all over the place, and you've probably heard it. Everybody's heard this thing, but the audio tape, the videotape of Bush and Michael Brown... And Brown saying, you know, we've got a big problem coming, and Bush going, well, we're going to do everything we can, not to worry, blah, 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 blah. And it looks like maybe Brownie was doing a heck of a job. And who was asleep at the switch? George W. Amazing. Rich in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program. Hello.
Yes. Hi. I was just wanting to ask you about the ports of the port deal with the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, it's closing today.
Yeah, it's Kuwait actually had a similar deal with the World Trade Center on 9/11 and the Dulles Airport. And that company was headed by George Bush. It was a company called Securecom, and they were owned by Kuwait.
Oh, that's interesting.
I don't understand why nobody's making the comparison.
I didn't know that. I might have read that somewhere along the line. The one little factoid that I do remember from 9/11 is that the morning of 9/11, George Bush Sr., as 9/11 was happening, was having breakfast with the brother of Osama bin Laden.
No, the company was called Securecom, and it was headed by Marvin Bush.
Mm-hmm. And Marvin Bush was responsible. No, actually, I thought that Marvin Bush had bailed out of owning the security. He actually ran the company that ran security for the World Trade Center, but I thought about a year and a half before 9/11 was when he sold that company or he bailed out.
Margie Burns wrote an article about it, and that's how I first found out about it. And I emailed her, and she's very nice. She emailed me back.
Yeah.
But it seems like that George Bush had a lot more to do with 9/11 than they're talking about.
He certainly had a lot more to do with the Middle Eastern countries than anybody's talking about.
Well, but 9/11 directly. It seems like they have enough evidence to go after him with the Patriot Act, and then they could freeze his assets. And
well, in order to do that, they're going to have a different attorney general, because I guarantee you, Alberto Gonzalez is not going to go after his boss, his mentor, and his lifelong friend.
That's probably true. This is the wrong administration to go after him with those kind of tools. But the point I'm trying to make is that the ports of Dubai deal is similar to the thing with the security for the 9/11 for the World Trade Center. That company also did security for Dulles Airport and American Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a connection.
Yeah.
And Marvin Bush was the head of the company. I mean, I don't mean to belabor the point.
Right.
But,
no, I got it.
It just seems like there seems like a hands-off policy on talking about 9/11 and George Bush.
No, I'm not at all reluctant to talk about 9/11 and George Bush. George Bush, 9/11 was the greatest security failure in the history of this country. And I'm not calling it an intelligence failure, because I believe we had the intelligence. It was a security failure. It was a failure to act on intelligence. And George Bush had no fewer than 50 specific warnings that these guys were going to hijack airplanes, that they were going to fly them into buildings, that they were going to attack us. We had Wusawi. We had so much information, and Bush completely dropped the ball. When I talked with Sandy Berger personally, and he told me how when he came in, when Condi Rice came into office, he sat her down. She took his job, National Security Advisor. He sat her down and he said, "Your number one priority is Osama bin Laden. He's coming to get us. We've tried to kill him a couple of times. We couldn't do it because he was always sitting there with all these princes from the United Arab Emirates, and we couldn't pull the trigger. Plus, all the Republicans were screaming, you know, no war for Monica. But you've got to watch Osama bin Laden because he's coming to get you." So what does Condi Rice do? Nothing. Bill Clinton said the same thing to George Bush, and Al Gore said the same thing to Dick Cheney. And so what does Bush do? He puts Dick Cheney in charge of in charge of the committee for counterterrorism, and that committee never met before September of 2001. So,
well,
you know,
the problem with 9/11 is that there's like Building 7 collapsed and it was barely on fire.
I know, Rich. It's an absolute enduring mystery, and I got no answer for that. And it's another reason why we have to have a decent investigation. Because in fact, the 9/11 Commission, the Building 7 is not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission.
Hello, Tom.
Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Hello,
hey, Gary.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
So am I. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad you mentioned Al Gore. Hopefully, I'll get to finish my thoughts. I know it's getting close to airtime here. I'm glad you. Thanks for mentioning Al Gore again. You know how I feel about Al Gore. It's true. And I wanted to mention this.
He's the greatest president of the United States who was never president of the United States.
Well, I didn't call because of him, but you did mention it, and my conscience says I have to mention Gore. I changed my mind about the VP. I think a Gore-Obama ticket would be the best for the Democratic Party.
Gore-Obama?
Yes, I do.
Interesting.
Yes, really.
You know, it probably would be something that would really go well. I also like Barbara Boxer. I like Russ Feingold.
Sure, I like all of them.
You know, there's a bunch of good candidates out there.
You know, it may be. I hope it doesn't come to this, and I know you do too. You can correct me if I'm mistaken, but we may have to walk in the end. You know this, right?
What do you mean?
We may have to walk as a country. Men, good men may have to walk. We may have to march.
Oh, you mean get out in the streets, like we did before in 2002, before the war started.
I'm hoping it doesn't come to that, but we may have to.
Yeah, if you're talking about nonviolent marching, I hope it does come to that, because I think it's important that the people of the world see that we're not sitting around going, George, he represents us. We like what he says. We're right there with him, because we're not. You know, we're really tired of being lied to. We're really tired of having an incompetent administration. We're really tired of our air getting dirtier, our water getting dirtier, our schools falling apart, our infrastructure crumbling, our billionaires and multimillionaires getting huge tax breaks while poverty is on the increase, while 30 million children and adults go to sleep hungry, while 45 million people don't have health insurance. We're really tired of it. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.